Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Orange County's a rough spot to visit, you know?
It is. It's hard.
People are always like, thank you for coming down. I'm like, you're welcome. I think I'm the one who should say thank you. But
yeah. No, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's a joy to be with you all. Good morning.
So I'd love for you to share a little bit of your journey, right?
Okay.
Kind of how you came to be pastor at Bridgetown Church.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of preceded that for you? I know you were a lead pastor in your late 20s,
mm-hmm.
right, at Solid Rock Church in Portland. And so just share a little bit of kind of what that was like for you. I know in some conversations that I've had with pastors leading up to today, you know, them knowing that you were coming speaking, was about kind of leadership, right?
Okay.
And what leadership looks like within the church, right?
I will let you down if you want leadership tips.
Keep trying to get success out of leadership, right? Success.
Yeah.
So in the world's eyes, right, you were kind of approaching the pinnacle of success in ministry, huge church, right? You're a young guy, and you stepped down from that.
Yeah.
So can you share with us?
You make it sound more virtuous than it really was. But as always, that's the Instagram version. Let me give you the real version.
Yes, please.
So grew up in the church. My dad was a first-generation follower of Jesus, came to faith in the Jesus movement, ended up at a church. I grew up in the Bay Area called, at the time, Los Gatos Christian Church, which, if the internet is true, and it always is, the internet never lies, apparently in the 70s there were only 10 churches over 2,000 people in the entire U.S., I'm not sure if that's true, but if that stat's anywhere close to true, it's a stunning commentary on just the story of the church in the West. So grew up in kind of West Coast mega church world, and this is before like mega church as we think of it. This is the 70s version of it, large church, you know? Grew up in that. He came to faith, became a pastor in his, I don't know, late 20s, 30-ish. Grew up in that cultural milieu, said I would never become a pastor, but not out of like rebellion against God or dad or anything like that, just for other reasons. But grew up in the faith, grew up with a great family, great parents. Ended up planting a church with my dad when I was 23 in suburban Portland metro area. And yeah, the church grew really fast. My dad and I kind of switched roles. And I ended up as the lead pastor, and it just grew really large, really fast. And so I hit about 30, and it was kind of your classic trope of church planter who burned out and had midlife crisis at 30 years old or whatever. It's so common that it's funny. And I remember I had this burnout moment, and I come from a church culture where there's almost no value for soul care, like in my childhood. And an amazing church, and I'm not bitter at all, but there was just no value for soul care, no value. Sabbath was not even on my radar. Therapy was right up there with Satan and secular music. You know, it was like,
of course.
Seriously, therapy was of the devil, and especially if you were a pastor, therapy was what you did after an affair because the elders made you do it. It was not a part of health or growth or maturity. So that's kind of the world I grew up in, you know. And of course, we're shaped by, for better or for worse, and usually for both, by the church environment and family environment and culture environment that we come up in. So, you know, I hit 30, and I remember when I was 23, I read The Emotionally Healthy Church by Pete Scazzaro. And it was on Rob Bell's, this was back when Rob Bell was like following Jesus and teaching the Bible and doing his thing. And it's been a while, if you can remember that. You have to be old enough to remember that. And he was amazing. And he had this recommended, and every, you know, I was 23. Every 23-year-old thought he was the coolest thing ever. And so you read everything he said to read. And I remember reading Emotionally Healthy Church. What a bizarre title. And I read it. I remember at 23, as we were planting, reading that, thinking, what? I loved it. I thought it was great. And it literally went in one ear and out the other. And over the next decade, I did every single thing that he said, don't do this. And then I came back to that book at 33, you know, kind of in a midlife crisis, burned out, and thought, I'm now ready to receive this. I wish I had been ready to receive this at 23, but I wasn't mature enough for it. And so, yeah, kind of hit burnout, and it was a combination. It wasn't just overwork. It was a combination of a lot of different things, of wrestling with who am I, who am I not, what is God's calling on my life, you know. Often, there's just so many expectations that are put on a pastor in general and a lead pastor in particular, and and so many expectations that nobody can measure up to, no matter how gifted or whatever, and I'm definitely not that. And my emotional capacity is not what I wish it was. I'm not, most lead pastors are like former college basketball players. They're almost all jocks. I'm like, I'm not at all. I read poetry and like walk in the woods and look at birds. Like that's, I'm not that guy, you know? I'm introverted. I'm not the, like, I just want to tussle with people and, like, fight it out and then go have a beer. I'm like, no, I don't want to tussle with people. I want to, you know, talk about philosophy. I joke, but honestly, like, my lack of emotional, you know, kind of, I don't know, fortitude and resilience has been, kind of my limp my whole time. And so just it was really coming to terms with my limitations. One of my favorite ideas from Scazzaro is, you know, he has that line, you find God's will for your life in your limitations. And our culture says so much about reaching your full potential, which is great. I'm all for that. But you have to balance that with the other side of the coin, which is accepting your limitations. And almost nothing is said about that in our culture. And especially for an upwardly mobile people, that becomes almost a toxic message if it's not side by side with accepting your limitations, image of God and made from the dust theologically. So I think for me, that was that moment of like accepting my limitations emotionally, my personality, God's call on my life, and realizing, oh, wow, I'm not called to be a leader of leaders and a staff of X number of people and a budget of, that's not what I am even made or built by God to do. So yeah, I resigned, maybe demoted myself is a more accurate word, about 5 years ago. Went on sabbatical, came back. We were a multi-site church, and we just graciously shut all of that down. Each church went autonomous. They're all doing pretty great. And I took our smaller church that was right in the city where my heart was, and I could walk to work, and our staff was like 3 people. It was really easy to pastor our staff, you know, when it was really small. I was like, I can do this as an introvert, you know. So I'm from 93 staff to 3 staff. And that was a wonderful transition. And so I've been there the last 5 years just trying to prioritize my soul over my leadership. And that's tricky, and that's, I feel like I constantly get those two backward. But that's been the last 5 years. And that, we can talk more about later, but that brought me into a journey around spiritual formation, the growth of the soul, psychology, none of which were even on my radar until my early 30s. And so the last 5-6 years of my life have all been deep dive, both in my own journey with Jesus and as a pastor and teacher and thinker around formation, psychology, spirituality, soul, health, Sabbath, discipline, how do people change? So lots of stuff there. But
no, yeah, I mean, you can keep going. They don't want to hear me. They want you talk. I would love to hear you share more about that, about this kind of change that occurred in you.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about psychology, how psychology was viewed beforehand. You talk about soul care, that just wasn't a concept that was really, you know, kind of embraced, let alone encouraged.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear you talk about that. But also, again, you kind of talked about we have these limitations, right? Yet you're 23, you read this book, it goes in one ear, out the other. So I'm kind of curious what happened in that 10-year span that you maybe noticed have been chasing this, mm-hmm. and it's just not fulfilling me.
Yeah.
If anything else, it's draining me.
Yeah.
I have these limitations. I have these capacities. Can you share more about just kind of that, what you saw kind of in the mirror that you were concerned about that gave you the courage to say, hey, I don't want to lead a staff of 93. This is kind of killing my soul.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's kind of two things. I'm hearing two questions in there. Yeah. One is around kind of emotional health, burnout, you know, and I don't have anything especially acute to share on that. Stuff that you'd mostly all know, that burnout is both the result of doing too much, which we all know, like we just overwork, we don't Sabbath, you go, people have expectations, you know, especially a lot of pastors, you know, are enmeshed in the psychological language or type 2s in the Enneagram, and so just will default to, or they're just workaholics, and we'll just go and go and go. And we have one of the few jobs where we can disobey the fourth commandment and get praised for it, where our workaholism is rewarded. Here's a raise, here's a promotion, here's 400 more people that came to your church, rather than rebuked. And that's a very, you need to understand that you will be rewarded for doing the wrong thing in your job, which is lots of jobs, but it's especially true for ours. And it's devious, because if you're like an accountant and you do the wrong thing, like everybody knows you just did the wrong thing, you know? Because you just lied about whatever. But if you're a pastor and doing the wrong thing means leading an extra Bible study or having an extra council appointment or staying, you know, extra, like nobody thinks of that as like, I'm lying about, you know, the accounting numbers or whatever. But it's still doing the wrong thing often for all the, or the right thing for the wrong reasons. So, you know, there's just the black hole that if you do not have firm boundaries around your life, the church is a just a black hole of people with genuine, authentic needs and desires and expectations and consumerism, good and bad, and it will just suck you in, you know. And at that point, you lose the capacity to even be a blessing to your church, because you're not the best version of yourself. I mean, I love Ruth Haley Barton's line: "The best gift you offer the people you lead is your transforming self." And, you know, I am so much more of a gift to my community when I'm an emotionally healthy version of myself doing what God made me to do than when I am an overworked, burned out, exhausted person trying to be everything to everybody and not doing what God made me to do. I'm far less of a blessing than to my church. So, which is back to limitation. So one is just you do too much. But then the other thing that was a harder one, so that one's easier. You just like put boundaries in your life and Sabbath, and you turn off your phone, and you have strict, you know what I mean, like rhythms around your life. And if you're not the lead pastor, then you work with your staff to make sure it's a healthy rhythm. And, you know, sometimes you have to quit. I remember my dad quit a job at one point because he realized I can't be present as a dad and work at this mega church. And so he had to quit his job and go to a smaller church in order to be the kind of dad that he wanted to be. And man, so that takes courage. More people need to do that than do that right now. More pastors need to do that right now than do it. So there's that. But then the second one that was harder for me is burnout is also a result of giving something. You know, Parker Palmer in his little book, Let Your Life Speak, if you've read that, which is short and there's a couple quirky moments in it, but overall it's so good. You know, he just makes the point that burnout isn't always a result of giving too much. Sometimes it's a result of giving something that you don't have to give in the first place. My interpretation of that would be sometimes it means, you know, not that you're working too many hours. It's that you are giving something that isn't yours to give. Like you're operating outside of your spiritual gifts in the language of evangelicalism, your personhood, whatever you want to call it. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, one of my mentors always reminds me to manage energy, not time. And I'll find that, you know, there's some things I can do for 10 hours of work and get done and feel like, great, what's for dinner? Let's make dinner. I'm relaxed. I can be present with the kids. Then there's other things like meetings, you know, like strategy meetings or whatever, where I can do for 3 hours and I'm like, I need a day off. Oh my gosh, you know? And so sometimes burnout isn't, you can work 40 hours a week and be super disciplined and always Sabbath and still feel burned out in your soul and lose energy and lose desire. And sometimes that's because we're trying, we're doing things that are outside of our gift set, or even sometimes we're doing the right things, but there's this inner emotional tension that's hard to put language to, where we're living under the expectations of other people that just is really draining. When the more energy and effort that you put into being somebody you're not, especially if it's to meet other people's expectations of you, you are draining your soul of energy, life, and vitality, even if you're really good in your spiritual disciplines and emotional health and exercise and all the stuff and drink plenty of water and eat plant-based. And you can do all the things and still be haggard because there's this inner emotional, you're trying to be something you're not, you know?
Yeah, so you're talking a lot, I think, about, and I appreciate it, about boundaries, right, and the ability to say no and knowing yourself, right, and not only knowing yourself but accepting yourself.
Yes, right? which is harder for me at least.
Yeah, so share about that. Like, how did you, what's that process look like for you? I mean, you talked about Sabbath has been a part of that. You kind of mentioned therapy a little bit.
Yeah, huge fan. What do you want me to say positive about therapy? I'll say it. I'll say it.
No, I would just love to hear your experience, right? I mean, not of therapy, but just that process, right? So you came to know yourself. You came to know your limitations.
Yeah.
You were faced with them, you know, right here.
Yes.
But then to be able to accept that took some time. It takes some energy.
And acceptance, obviously, for followers of Jesus looks different. So a lot of Christians are allergic to that language of self-acceptance because in the secular culture, what people mean by that is let me sin and do whatever the heck I want and don't judge me. That's obviously not what we mean by self-acceptance as followers of Jesus. What I mean is like accepting the fact that I'm not an alpha male extrovert, that I am, that's not how God wired me. Accepting the fact that other people can work these hours, do these things, speak this many times, and still be like, great, I got energy. I'm like exhausted and not even sure I'm a Christian anymore or whatever. You know what I mean? I don't have that emotional capacity. So that's what acceptance looks like for me. It's not acceptance of my sin. I never want to accept my sin. I want to grow and mature. It's acceptance of my personality type, my wiring, my emotional limitations, the limitations of family. I mean, we all have limitations. Your personality is a limitation. Your gender is a limitation in a good way. But your role at your church is a limitation. Your stage of life is a limitation. I have 3 children right now. Limitation 1, limitation 2, limitation 3, you know? And I mean, I just was reminded yesterday of the stats on time. You know, they say that your free time is cut in half by 50%, with every familial relationship. So meaning you get married, you have half as much free time as you had when you were single. You have a kid, you have 25% much free time as you had. You have 2 kids, you're down to 12 point something. I have 3. I'm running on 6.something% of the free time that I had when I was a single person, you know? And it makes sense of why Paul has a case for celibacy in the kingdom of God, because you're devote, like seriously, he knows he'll get 93% more work out of people in the church if they don't ever marry, you know?
Yeah.
And children are a limitation. This season, I mean, we had kids pretty young. And so our oldest kid will theoretically, hopefully, leave home in 5 years. And like, oh, I have 5 years before my son is gone. And it's interesting, one of my best friends who's on our board of directors and in our home community, we were processing this yesterday. Just, it's so interesting that the prime years of our career, or they're probably not actually, but we think of them as the prime years of our career in our 30s and 40s, are the years where we have the least time to give to our career because the most is demanded of us at home. And I thought, man, what an interesting conspiracy between God and nature. You know what I mean? And there's such a gift there. So all that, I'm digressing.
No,
sorry.
Okay.
So what happens when you don't have notes in front of you and you're just talking about whatever and you should have slept longer last night. But I think there is just the acceptance of limitations. So back to your question, some of the things that were key journeys for me were Sabbath was life-changing. And I began that pre-sabbatical kind of. I began a slow, gradual journey into Sabbath. I had no mentorship in it. Like, I literally did not know a single person practicing Sabbath. I didn't even get to it through a Christian. I got to it through Abraham Joshua Heschel. I don't even remember how his little book came into my life, but it came into my life, and I read it. It's short. You can read it in a sitting. And I was floored. And then I read it again, and I was still floored, and I read it again. It literally sat on my bedside table for probably 2 or 3 years, just kind of reading and rereading, because it was new ideas to me. And it's so tragic to me that Sabbath, which is this ancient Christian discipline, had to come to me through a Jew and through a book rather than through a mentor or a church tradition. So that was slow, it was gradual. My wife was really, who is now all in, was really slow to adopt it. And if you have a spouse or a family, you kind of all have to Sabbath in order for it to actually be a Sabbath. It's pretty hard to like Sabbath while your wife's like, I need you to do this. And what about this? And did you fix that? And your children are, you know, I need help with math homework. It's not quite Sabbath-y. So it's something different. So there was a slow, gradual journey. So Sabbath was huge. I began therapy, which it was really out of desperation. It was out of, you know, and I'd love to maybe talk into this in a minute, yeah. But I just felt stuck in my own spiritual formation. And there was no gross sin in my life. I never had an affair. I never stole any money from the church. I'm a good, like, I'm the older brother, prodigal son story. I, like, grew up in the church. I don't cuss. I don't watch R-rated movies. I'm, like, old school. I masquerade as this Portland, like, progressive. I'm so not. I, like, think Netflix is horrible and no Christian should be on there. Like, I'm actually quite conservative. I drink wine. That's about as crazy as I get, you know? And I didn't ever taste alcohol until I was in my 30s. Like, I'm actually like this closet older brother from the prodigal son story. And, I came in, so there's no like gross sin in my life, but I was still a very sinful person. And it looked like things like perfectionism was just destroying my marriage, my health, my parenting, my closest relationships and staff. And I couldn't fix it. I couldn't fix it through Bible reading, prayer, church attendance, and willpower. Just that wasn't fixing me. And I was actually getting worse, not better, more perfectionistic, critical. If the center of transformation is love, I was not a loving person. I didn't love myself. I didn't love my wife. I didn't love my children nearly in the way that I wanted to. And so I was almost forced into it through desperation. Like, I can't. Like, what I'm doing is not working. Like, reading the Bible more, fasting more, praying more, and going to church a lot and trying really hard is not dealing with the fact that I'm a perfectionist, my marriage is disappointing, and I'm taking it out on my wife in criticism and unkindness. That's not, something in me is broken, you know? So I came into therapy, and by the grace of God, I just ended up with a really good therapist. I've come to realize the hard way, I'm such an advocate for therapy now, that you can't recommend therapists anymore, therapy in general, any more than you can recommend like religion in general. Like, some of it is toxic and will do far more damage to the soul. And there's such a vulnerable space where you're there, you're safe and open with somebody, and you let them into the deepest recess of your heart, but there's no accountability. There's no church. There's no authority. There's no community around you. It's just you and that person. And if that person is speaking truth over you, then it's powerful. And if they're speaking lies over you, it's toxic. So I was, by the grace of God, just entered with a great therapist. He's a PhD, 70-something Quaker dude who pastored a church and then has been a really successful therapist and is kind of in his retirement years, just takes a few clients. And the head of the seminary in town, I was like, do you know of any good therapists? I need help. And he's like, there's only one in town. You need somebody who's smarter than you. And I have the perfect person for you. And he's not taking you, but I'll get you in. And so he got me in, and it has been a life-changing experience for me. 6 years in now. I mean, one of the most life-changing experiences in my life. So all that to say, I've just become such an advocate for good therapy. Spiritual direction, mentorship has been huge. Working no more than 45 hours a week has been huge. Long vacations have been huge. Overall, holistic health, just as far as diet, exercise, stuff like that. Spiritual disciplines, recovering them. Like, I grew up reading my Bible and praying every morning, but recovering like more ancient forms of prayer and waiting on God and processing before God and lots of time in the quiet with God. And life in community, having like some very close relationships where there's a lot of honesty and vulnerability. And I don't need very many, but several that are like close and very connected to me. These things have become like kind of my life-changing rhythms. Sabbath, discipline, less work, therapy, spiritual direction, long vacations, close friendships. These things have become, and self-awareness have become key for me.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
And I know listening to you, you know, talk about just those changes that you made, and I love that the person, the president of that university said, I got to find somebody smarter than you.
Yeah.
Right. You and I were talking in the back, beforehand about just kind of where maybe psychology and the church
yes.
are at currently.
Yeah.
And where they were at, you know, historically.
Yes.
I'd love to hear you, cause you just shared like 2 minutes back there and I was, you know, kind of salivating, wanting to hear more.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'd love to for you to share, you know, kind of your thoughts on that, and maybe that'll be a bridge for
this
us.
This is my paid endorsement of all things SIF. No, I'm kidding.
No, yeah, because it was about
Where
it was in the church.
A passion of mine. I mean, all I was saying before was one of the great aches of my – I'd love to maybe in a moment talk about spiritual formation and why most evangelical churches don't produce –
Absolutely.
Fully mature, transformed people, even though they have very good theology often. But one of my great aches has been the separation of psychology, theology, and philosophy. Prior to, unless if I'm misreading the data points, prior to the Enlightenment, those were not separate disciplines, not separate academic disciplines. So the pastor or the priest was as much philosopher, sociologist, and therapist as they were theologian. You read, you know, St. John of the Cross or Teresa, and you are reading top-notch psychology. Gerald May, if you've read any of his work, he's a PhD psychiatrist and spiritual director. He has a little book called The Dark Night of the Soul that you should all read. It's absolutely, even if you're not in The Dark Night of the Soul, my wife's reading it right now, and she's doing great with hearing God's voice and all that. It's so profound, and it's his psychological summary / commentary on St. John and Teresa's framework. And he basically argues that both St. John and Teresa had a better grasp of inner dynamics than both Freud and Jung, and that they were saying 500 years before modern scientific psychology, basically what the cutting-edge psychological research is saying, but actually a little bit better. And so in the Enlightenment, you know, like academically, and some of you are academics, you don't get this better than me, but everything's subdivided, and the scientific method, so first everything's subdivided. So philosophy, so, and I used to have, like, even 200 years ago, the pastor was also like a botanist, and you know, Albert Schweitzer is like a doctor and a naturalist and a theologian, and you're like, wait a minute, you can't do that. Nobody really does that anymore, with a few random exceptions. Even Francis Collins, or you wouldn't have Francis Collins publish a book on like the theology of incarnation or whatever. He could do a book on Genesis. That's all you're allowed to do, you know? And because everything has subdivided, which isn't necessarily bad. We're like our field, we have more cumulative knowledge as a human species than ever. But then all these disciplines have then been subjected to the scientific method. That's why in philosophy, and again, I know just enough to be dangerous, there's been almost no progress forward in philosophy for 200 years, because the scientific method can't help you determine what the good life is, because you're not supposed to have a value judgment in the scientific method and say good from evil. So philosophy is no longer the study of the good life, it's the study of philosophy and the study of how people make decisions about the good life. That's a very different question. That's an epistemological question, not an actual like philosophical question. So one of my great aches is that in the Enlightenment, theology was separated and spirituality was separated from psychology and philosophy and sociology, which were then fully secularized. And it's such a tragedy. I mean, the priest, the pastor before the Enlightenment was called in Latin, the cure, the cure of souls. That can be translated cure or care. So the priest's job was both to care for the soul in his local parish and to cure it, to actually be a part of what we would call inner healing or healing of memories or wounds. That was the priest's job. And it's so tragic that after the Reformation, the job became basically to teach the Bible and help people pray, but without dealing often with the holistic person. And then the Enlightenment, still Descartes and others, gave us a very flat, one-dimensional view of the human person as a mind, basically, in a body, rather than as a holistic soul, which is what Christians had said for thousands of years and just most smart people had said. But obviously the Enlightenment flattened everything out. So what we have now is we have Bible, theology, and Christian spirituality. Often Bible and theology are separated from Christian spirituality, but over here you have that, and then you have psychology, which is often thoroughly secularized, and that's a great tragedy in my opinion, and again, I know just enough to be dangerous, so feel free to correct me at any point. I'm a learner with all of this, but you know, in a true secular, scientific, psychological context, again, science is supposed to be value-free. So you can't make value judgments. So it's pretty hard to help somebody therapeutically if you can't make value judgments for them. So if a couple comes to a secular scientific psychologist with marriage problems, he or she can't say, you need to stay in your marriage, and this is why you need to stay in your marriage, and this is what it will do that will make you into a better person. Those are all value judgments. So you have Woody Allen, who goes to his therapist every single week for 30 years and has a cunning and insightful grasp of his inner phenomenology and could name for you, this is what's messed up about me, this is how I got messed up, and he still married his stepdaughter and is still a disaster because self-awareness is not the same thing as healing. And that's where spiritual formation, which is essentially, I think, an attempt to bring psychology, theology, and spirituality back together, has so much to offer because we, not we as in us, but we have access to spirit and truth and the community of Jesus where the healing is. So psychology is so helpful to understand what's wrong and how it got broken. But secular psychology, I find grossly unhelpful to actually heal it, fix it, and move forward. And so that's where spiritual formation can then take the next step and open up that wound. Oh, this is where I messed up. Oh, this is my inner phenomenology. Oh, it's rooted in this thing from my past or family or personhood or whatever experience. And so how do I now invite the spirit and truth and community of Jesus into this for healing? So all that to say, I have a great passion. We need more Christian therapists who do therapy from a Christian perspective, who have value judgments. And we need more pastors that are educated in psychology to bring these two things back together for the growth of the soul. That's like a deep conviction of mine.
Yeah. No, thanks for saying. You haven't thought any about that, I'm sure, right? I mean, nothing there. You mentioned you want to say a little bit more about spiritual formation, more than what you said.
Yeah, I mean, this crowd, this is all kind of speaking to the choir, as the saying goes, but part of the reason I resigned from that megachurch I was a part of was because I just realized that I got stuck in my transformation, if you want to use like very New Testament language. And, you know, I just experienced this phenomenon in my own journey with Jesus where grew up in the church, was always following Jesus as long as I can remember, thankfully, by the grace of God. And I just have this experience of like high school, college, even early 20s, I felt like I was growing. I felt like year over year, I was more like Jesus, more in tune with Jesus, more on about what Jesus was on about in the world. And then, you know, I don't know what age it was for me exactly, but somewhere in there, 25, 26-ish, I just felt like I hit a plateau and I got stuck. And, you know, if you take like, you know, Robert Mulholland in Invitation to a Journey, if you've read that, if not, it's such a good kind of spiritual formation in one book thing. He has, you know, his four layers of purgation, which is his interpretation of kind of early church fathers and mothers. And it first is, you know, gross sins, which is ancient language. It doesn't mean gross like ew. It means like murder and adultery and theft and all that. Second is, I think he calls it deliberate sins, which are socially acceptable sins. So for us, it would be like Netflix or watching Game of Thrones or stuff that in the world is totally cool and okay, but in the kingdom is not. Third level down is, I think he calls them unconscious sins, which these are sins of motivation, where you're doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. There are sins of omission, not commission, where you're just not doing the right thing. They're, you know what I mean? They're patterns. They're like more internal than external. They're more about kind of interpersonal relationships. And then his bottom layer is what he calls trust structures. This is Thomas Keating's idea of like emotional programs of happiness. They're rarely sinful things at all, but they're things. It could be ministry, it could be marriage, it could be parenting, it could be writing a book, it could be anything, good or bad, mostly good, that we look to, we put our trust in for our emotional happiness that don't go by the name of God. And how like God is always, purgation is about working through these layers of sin in our life. And my experience is that the church model I grew up in and the discipleship model I grew up in was great with the first two layers. It like was great at like getting me to, you know, not have sex outside of marriage and not watch R-rated movies. But it was almost worthless once I started dealing with levels 3 and 4. And I just got stuck. And I was this interesting thing where, and what I mean by stuck is, I like to talk about the difference between unwillingness to change and like unable to change. Some people in our churches are unwilling to change. Like they won't move out with their girlfriend or they won't stop sleeping around or they won't stop whatever. They're just unwilling. They're not even interested in obedience. Most people in our church are willing. They're unable. They want to stop yelling at their children. They can't. They want to stop looking at porn. They can't. They want, in my case, I wanted to stop being a critical, condescending, perfectionist jerk, but I couldn't. That's who I was, and I couldn't fix it through Bible reading and prayer. And I was stuck in some of these deeply ingrained habits of sin in my mind and body, none of which would ever get me fired from working at a church, and some of them actually made me good at growing to make a church, but they were still brokenness and dysfunction and wounding and pain. And I realized, man, it's not that I'm not trying to change, not that I don't want to change, I really did want to change, and it wasn't that I wasn't trying to change, I was trying my butt off. I was working so hard to change, and it was that I didn't know how. And then it hit me like, oh my gosh, my church is full of people like me, which is the most obvious thing, and like was new information to me. And I honestly thought, oh crap. Like somehow I imbibed this, and I was never, ever, ever taught this by my dad, by any mentor, by my mom. Never was I taught this. But somehow I assimilated the message that Jesus' call to pick up your cross, deny yourself, and follow him meant sacrifice your emotional health on the altar of church planting and ministry. And nobody ever said that to me, but somehow that's the message I picked up, and I'm happy to take blame for it. Somehow I interpreted it that way, and I realized, oh my gosh, I've been almost working under the impression, let me kill myself so that other people can grow and be happy. And then obviously that's not remotely how pastoral leadership works. I love Scazzaro's line, as the leaders go, so goes the church. You know what I mean? Your church will look like you, whether you want it to or not. There are things you can mitigate against it through team leadership and humility and whatever. But it's going to take on the good things about you and the bad things about you. And that's a separate conversation. But in his whole line is, a church rarely rises above the maturity of its highest levels of leaders. And that, for me, such a simple pastoral, like, of course, 101, for me at 30 was like new information that wrecked me. And I realized, man, my church is full of people like me who kind of had some quick wins early after conversion, got life kind of basically together, and then got stuck the second they were dealing with family of origin, personality stuff, deeply ingrained habits of sin and mind and body, thought narratives that were, you know what I mean, just got stuck, and they were the same thing. It's not that they didn't want to change. Most of them did, and it's not that they weren't trying to change. Most of them were. It's that they were stuck like I was stuck. They didn't know how to change. And so that kind of brought me to that crisis point, resigned, and then I went on a, you know, several-year, like, binge of reading and research around spiritual formation, psychology. And I'd been reading Willard. That was one of the reasons I stepped down. He was just ruining me. And you know, you have to read Willard a lot to figure out what the heck he's saying. So I remember reading Divine Conspiracy, and, you know, my mentor was like, this is my favorite book. I'm like, okay. And I read it. It took me like 3 months. I'm like, it's amazing. But I don't think I really got it. And then I read it again, and I just started to maybe a little bit get, and the same with Spirit of the Disciplines was actually the book that destroyed me. And I remember reading and thinking, oh, that's great. I should teach on the spiritual disciplines for a little bit or something. And I remember coming back to it and like, oh my freaking gosh, I've never heard this before. So he was like, I call him my gateway drug to all things spiritual for me. I'm from Portland. We have lots of marijuana. It makes sense where I'm from. I don't have lots of marijuana, but... So he was kind of my entry point into all of this, and I'm still a learner very much. I'm still learning about all this stuff. But what was disturbing to me, and I'll wrap it up here, was going on this binge, reading research, spiritual formation, which takes me to psychology and neurobiology and family of origin and generational stuff, and takes me to all, and health and Sabbath and spiritual disciplines and soul and the growth of the soul and St. Teresa and St. John. It takes me to all this stuff, prayer. And what was shocking to me was that probably 75% of it was new information to me. And I'm in my early 30s. I grew up in the church. Good churches. I'm the son of a pastor. Grew up basically drawing pictures in the back of elders' meetings. Went to Bible college. Went to seminary. Graduated summa cum laude. Pastored a mega church. Was writing books. Was an avid reader. And 75% of what I was, let's just throw that number out, but a large chunk of what I was learning about how people change was new information to me. And that could just be my experience. It could just be that I love my seminary, but somehow I you think the first thing they would teach you in Bible college or seminary is, all right, this is how people change to become more like Jesus. And if they taught me that, I wasn't paying attention. I was on Instagram that day. They probably did teach me that, and I just skipped class or something. But that, again, I'm not playing the victim card, that it never got to me. And you think that'd be the first thing we would learn? Like, this is like basic psychology. You think that'd be the first thing you would teach people? Or that we would want to ask the first question? And that's not the questions I was asking. I was asking questions about Bible and theology and church leadership and growth. Those are different questions than the growth of the soul into union with God and love for him and other people. How do we mature into people who embody love and joy and peace, the central virtues of the kingdom of God? Not even virtues, dispositions of a Christ-like man or woman. I think that would be the driving question of our life. How do we grow in love and joy and peace, and how do we lead others to grow in love and joy and peace in union with Jesus? And that was just not the question. That I didn't even really ask those questions until I was in my 30s and was tired of church growth, Bible theology, and being an unchristlike person. And again, I love Bible theology, and church leadership is great. I don't really care that much anymore, but it matters. So, that's been the great passion for me, is realizing, man, I think somehow when you're not taught or you don't ask the right questions around spiritual formation, you just pick up ones unconsciously. And I think because I didn't come from the charismatic tradition, I think the two great kind of working theory, what I always say is just you need a working theory of spiritual formation. I have one now. I don't know if it's right, but at least I have one, and we've re-architected our whole church around it because I realized the one I started with unconsciously was definitely not right. And, you know, in my church tradition, which was more kind of Bible church tradition, I think my working theory, again, I would never have articulated it. It was never articulated to me, but it was basically biblical theology in church plus willpower equals change. Now, we never would have said that. We would have said, read your Bible and pray, go to church, and let the Spirit do it. But all the Spirit stuff was so Christian cliche that it was never, and I have a fairly logical mind, it was never explained to me how. So people would always say, it's God who does the work, not you. But it was always in cliche, allegory, Christianese, and it was never like, well, what does that mean? Because I feel like he's not doing it, and I'm burned out and exhausted and trying really hard, and I'm not changing. So you say that God does the work, but what does that mean? And I get it now, and some of the cliches now make sense as vague ways of describing some of the inner mechanisms of spiritual formation, but I just didn't get it then. And so I think for a lot of people, it's kind of, know the Bible and go do it in the power of the Spirit, but that really means just go try hard, is how I interpreted it. And then in the charismatic tradition, it's more like just sing for a long time until you encounter and have like a zap from the Holy Spirit, and that's how you changed, you know? And I'm in the charismatic tradition now, so I feel like I can critique from the inside. But often that is the charismatic view of spiritual formation. You just sing for a long time, and you just wait for the zap. And, so one is hyper-focused on information. The other is hyper-focused on experience. Both of them are passive, in a sense, you know, other than study the Bible and show it for church. Both of them don't involve going to the place of pain in your life. They don't really involve community. They don't show practical ways, really, other than church, which is huge, to open your mind and body up to the healing power of the Spirit. So, and they both of those working theories of change have a lot of truth in them. They're just missing some key components. And so what I find is most stories of transformation in the church are all early transformation. So we tell a lot of stories about healing and freedom and very few stories about maturity, because most of those, both the charismatic model and the Bible model, help people deal with the first two levels of sin, gross sins and deliberate sins. They don't do as much with the second two layers. So when we tell stories at most churches of testimony or whatever, normally it's like, I was a drug addict and I've been clean and I'm full of the joy of Jesus, you know, or I was a bitter, angry, whatever, and I was set free from my father. And these beautiful stories, which are amazing. We rarely tell stories about, I was a really impatient, hurried person, and now I am so patient and present to the moment, you would not even believe it. We just don't tell a lot of those stories. I was the most undisciplined, disorganized, whatever. And now I like get up at 4, I fast and pray naked for revival. then I go to CrossFit, then I eat celery and drink water with vitamin minerals in it. And then I, you know what I mean? Like, and I'm perfectly, like, we don't tell those stories because those are stories of maturity, and they normally take 30 years, not 3 months through our church program. So again, it doesn't mean, this is not to criticize the church, it's just I realize, oh wow, like I'm in a church context and a discipleship context, even if I'd left the church, I would have had the same problem but worse, where I'm only really dealing with the early stuff of discipleship. I'm not actually dealing with the deep soul health and transformation to love. And I needed a new working theory.
Yeah. No, I mean, so much in there that we could unpack, for sure. And I appreciate you kind of identifying that it's not about just trying harder.
Yeah.
It's not about working harder. It's not about just a will.
Which I never, don't think I would have said that.
Yeah.
And it definitely wasn't said to me. But that is honestly what a lot of us think,
no,
I think.
For sure.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely. What I love, and I'm going to kind of transition you a little bit to the podcast, because I think a lot of us here would love to hear your thoughts on culture.
Okay.
But so as you were talking
in that
there,
podcast, I just ask questions and
I know,
and try to interpret answers.
You're Mark,
so
and I'm
not Mark. No, no,
so,
I'm not Mark. Yeah. I have no. I'm not.
Mm. Okay, fine.
Great. Just prepare to be disappointed is all I'm saying.
Well, you're talking about the long road, if you will, right? And I just actually finished reading your book, God Has a Name,
okay,
which I thought is powerful, right? And in there, you talk about covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and just the idea of covenant, and that God has made a covenant with his people, and we don't have to unpack this today. I maybe encourage people to pick this up and read, but to figure out what God has promised us, right? That God hasn't promised us an easy life.
Yeah.
God hasn't promised us happiness.
Health, wealth,
health,
yeah.
You know, all the things that culture would say that we are promised.
Yeah.
Right? And so in the podcast, Mark talks about pact.
Right? Yes.
And so as you're kind of talking, and PACT is this acronym for passive-aggressive consumer trap.
Yes.
Right? And he talks about how this passive-aggressive consumer trap has infiltrated the church in certain ways. Right? And so I'd love for you, if you can, maybe to just share a little bit about what you were seeing both within the church and within culture that motivated you and Mark to kind of launch this podcast. But also, just to give us, you know, I think in your podcast, you talk a lot about, you know, the first season, I think, is about post-Christian, right? And what is post-Christian? Second season is about secularism, and what is secularism, right? But I'd love for you to kind of share with us what you're seeing in Portland, what you're seeing kind of around the country, around the globe, and then what you would encourage us to look for, both within ourselves, within our churches, in terms of culture's influence. And then I think if you can get there, how do we pastor into this culture?
Yeah. Yeah, those are some big questions that I just have a few theories, but I don't have answers for any of that set, you know? Yeah, when I got into the spiritual formation literature, one of the things that was really helpful for me was just to realize that spiritual formation isn't a Christian thing, it's a human thing. Meaning, if you define spiritual formation just de-Christianize it and just say the process by which you are formed from your spirit, your inner immaterial part, out into somebody or something, that's happening to all of us right now as we speak, whether we want it to or not, whether it's intentional or unintentional, and whether it's Christian or Buddhist or pagan or secular, it's happening to us. You know, anthropologically, you know, what's the saying? Human beings are like sharks, they can't stop moving, meaning you're always becoming somebody. The kind of simple metaphor I use that is a little dicey because it's a little ageist, but I just do my best to graciously point out that if you run through your kind of mental Rolodex of elderly people, you know, say 80s or older, very few of them are like middle of the road. They tend to either be the best people you know, who are so happy, so full of love, so at peace, so non-controlling, so flexible, so grateful, like a they're just incredible people. I was just with my wife's grandmother, who's 96, who's dying. Everything's horrible. She's dying. Her husband died. She just broke her hip. She's in a terrible little home. They don't have a lot of money. She's not in a great She's in a home, but she just had to move. She has no friends. They're like, all the metrics are basically bad. And I was sitting with her over Thanksgiving for about 30 minutes just chatting with her, kind of trying to get her to give me the dirt of like what it's like to basically be 96 and dying and unwell. She's very unwell. And I just couldn't get her to complain. The worst thing I could get her to say was, getting old is for the birds. That's the worst thing. And she was just joyful, asking me questions, you know, present in her inner wheelchair, you know. So they're either like, that's kind of who we think of, or we think of elderly people who are honestly like Satan, who are just like the worst. That's an exaggeration, but who are just critical and demanding. And I think of another grandmother in my sphere who was narcissistic to the end, who died in manipulation and bitterness and regret. And wow, there's not like, when you think about 20-somethings, most 20-somethings are just kind of middle of the road. Like, you know, I'm 38, so my experience over the last decade has been in your 20s, you kind of have this plasticity to your personality. You're kind of like, who will I become? You know what I mean? This is kind of this like fun, scary but fun question. And now I'm kind of like, oh crap, this is who I became. You know what I mean? I can only imagine what that feels like at 48 or 58 or 68. You know, I'm guessing you feel less and less plastic, which I know neurobiologically, like, you can still change and all that stuff. But I think that's just the felt experience of you're becoming somebody. So back to your question, I think it was really key for me to realize, oh wow, before anybody ever walks in the door to our church on a Sunday, where I sit down to help people, somebody with spiritual formation one-on-one or in a group or whatever, they have already been spiritually formed by our culture, by the iPhone, by urban life, by their family of origin, by their ethnicity, by the socio-political stream that they came up in, by their income class, by their education, by all sorts of things, by events in their life, good and bad. They've been formed. They already are somebody. And it may be they've been formed to become like Christ, but there are powerful currents of culture that are spiritually deforming every single person that we lead. We don't start with a blank slate. And again, so simple, and I was just late to the game on a lot of this stuff. Wow, we don't start with a blank slate, and everything we do in spiritual formation is actually counterformation, is a better title for it, because people not already have been formed, every single day they are being formed by their phone, by the outlet from which they get their news, by a chat with a coworker, by what they're watching on Netflix, by the social norms of our society, for emerging theories around marriage and gender, and we have been formed. You know, I mean, I was just chatting with somebody yesterday about marriage and how radically different a Christian theology of marriage is from an American theology of marriage. And it's theology is really the right word, because people look to marriage as like almost a soteriology, a doctrine of salvation, of personal fulfillment and happiness and meaning and acceptance and love. And like, it's a religion that doesn't work. It can't bear the weight. And so the divorce rate is just through the roof. And I just thought, man, most Christians go into marriage with a secular theory of what marriage is, which is basically, this is a person to make me happy and, you know, personal fulfillment, all this stuff. And that's not a Christian theology of marriage. And it is a recipe for disillusionment at best, divorce or worse. But we just have been so spiritually formed, you know what I mean? And often we go into it and then we're just trying. So much of the Christian marriage literature, I can't stomach. It's just a Christianized version of the secular attempt to propagate the honeymoon period, which is, that's not even a Christian vision of what love is. And I don't need like a date night packet to like bring spice back into it. I need to like become more Christ-like. I'm all for date night. If you have a date night packet, that's great. Spontaneity, sure, fine. But I don't need like somebody to try the neurobiological 6 to 2 6 month to 2 year like high that you get when you first fall in love. I don't need somebody to try to make that last from 2 years to 2.5 years. I need somebody to teach me what happens after it's gone. It's gone for everybody. What does love look like then? What does Christ-like love and relationship and intimacy and self-sacrifice and delight look like, you know, 17 years into a marriage? So we digress. We keep digressing. I'm so sorry.
I'm hearing some amens out there, so it's okay.
This is why I teach from notes and I don't just stand up and talk. Those really smart pastors, they just kind of have a vague outline and a sense from God and they get up and they're brilliant. I am not one of them. I have to write everything out or I do this. So all that to say, that was a learning experience for me. And an easy example would be, because I grew up in the 80s and 90s, I was in church leaderships early, you know, from my dad's generation down, one of the things that pastors would lament is the way that consumerism has deformed the church. That people who are good people, love Jesus, Christian worldview, read the Bible every morning, come into the church with this consumer mindset. And tragically, much of American, in particular megachurch culture, but just church general and culture in general, rather than prophetically arresting consumerism at the door, has actually capitalized on it and played the like comparison competition game with other churches to try to build a church off of consumerism rather than prophetically arresting it and letting people be reformed back into the image of Jesus. Great tragedy. Most of us get that. But that was a different moment when you had people who still came in the door with a basic Judeo-Christian ethical vision. They just were very capitalistic and consumeristic in their kind of sociological vision, and they carried that over into the church, and it created all sorts of damage for baby boomers and below. We're way past that now. And especially, you know, if you're in a city like Portland, but it's becoming true everywhere. What used to be, the phone changed everything. Immigration in the 60s changed everything. I don't mean that in a political way bad. I'm just saying it brought other worldviews into America in close proximity. Secularization changed everything, and the phone changed everything. Those three factors, people that were not from a Judeo-Christian worldview, secular mindset, and the phone, have changed the reality of church. And we're just grappling to try to catch up with how the heck to do church right now. And we definitely don't have all the answers where I'm from, but I think we're asking some good questions. But I think the phone changed everything in that what used to be locked in like the urban core of a Portland or a Seattle or Manhattan is now in everybody's front right pocket. So to get exposed to the insanity that is my city and where I live in, you used to have to live in urban Portland or San Francisco or Manhattan. Now you can live in like, pick whatever the most conservative part of Orange County is. What is it? I don't know. Mission Viejo. I don't know. Whatever the most conservative. I don't mean that in a bad, conservative is not an insult. Oh my gosh, my goodness. No. Well, it kind of is, but it depends who it's coming from, you know? Whatever. Let's go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Like, I mean, just wherever. That's actually Democratic. Bill Clinton was there. Whatever. Alabama. I don't know. Pick your conservative, you know, enclave of choice. If people have a phone and Wi-Fi, they're being exposed to the most progressive secular worldview. Plus now, and Trump, without getting political, is a great example of how the right has been secularized. So the left has been secularizing for decades, but the right has been more tricky because it's been this more Christendom mix of capitalistic Republican values with Christian values, but now it's fully secular. I mean, that's just burning up, and it is just as secular as the left. Secularism just looks different on the right than it looks on the left, but it's still secularism. And I don't remotely think that the Republican Party or the right is any more Christian now than the Democratic Party. They're both woefully out of touch with Jesus' vision, in my opinion. Just to talk about politics in Orange County, just to like, because I don't live here and I don't pass it, whatever, I can say whatever I want. So
careful, we live here.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, this is the you're not going to invite me back, so I have no need. I'm just here. I can say whatever. My point is, we're this hyper secular, often progressive, but even not progressive. It could be a Trumpian kind of secularism on the right is now everywhere. And everybody's getting exposed to it. And it's forming people. I'm talking too much. One of the things that I realized is that first, people are coming to me already spiritually deformed away from the image of Jesus. And two, much of the counter practices by which we are spiritually formed into the image of Jesus have been totally lost over the last 50 years. And this was a wake-up call for me. It's why one of the things we restructured our whole church around. So what I realized is that think about what we call the spiritual disciplines, or up north we just call them the practices of Jesus. Whatever you want to call them, the habits of the kingdom of God, they're all just based on the details of Jesus' life. They're all based on the fact that Jesus comes to us through four biographies. So I just went up, when we do like our new to the church class, I just graciously help people realize that the four gospels are biographies. I talk about biographies. What is a biography? Why do you read a biography? Nine times out of 10, if not more than that, you read a biography of somebody that you find fascinating, and you want to either copy or avoid the details of their life in order to have something similar to what happened to them happen to you. So if you are an entrepreneur, you read Musk's biography, you read Jobs' biography, and you like, what did they do? Oh, Bill Gates takes a week every year and he just reads. Oh, they do this. Oh, and then you start to work those little details into your life, and you know you're not Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, but your hope is that some of what happened to them will happen to you if you copy the details of their life, right? Or if it's a nefarious person like an Elon Musk or whatever, you want to both copy and avoid, you know? And the tragedy is almost no Christians read the four Gospels that way. Almost nobody reads the four Gospels saying, oh, Jesus got up early and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. How could I work something like that into my weekly routine or something so that I might experience something like what Jesus has on offer? It's this very reformational, very Calvinist, very legal, transactional. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but this kind of legal transactional view of salvation as something that's done to you rather than something that you participate in with Christ through discipleship. In the post-reformational version of the gospel, you don't have to apprentice under Jesus to experience the kingdom of God. You just have to believe. Something's wrong. Jesus said you have to apprentice under him to experience the good news of his kingdom. So when we lose that, we've lost something tragic. So what I realized is that spiritual disciplines, which are based on the details of Jesus' life, are not commanded by Jesus. The only spiritual discipline that he really commands is prayer, and you could argue that's actually not a spiritual discipline. It's what all the spiritual disciplines are supposed to create space for. And he commands prayer, but other than that, he basically doesn't command any of them. He just does all of them, and then he says, come and follow me. And follow the example of my life. And same with Paul. He doesn't really command you to get up in the morning and pray. He doesn't even command you to go to church on the weekend. He doesn't command you. He just says, like, imitate me as I imitate Christ. He does all of these things. And then he says, here's the theological backing behind him. Now come copy the way that I live as I copy the way that Jesus lived. So what I realized was that spiritual disciplines are generally, as the saying goes, caught, not taught. And they're best learned in family and in small communities and in mentoring relationships. So my pastor didn't teach me how to follow Jesus. He taught me Bible and theology and some good spiritual principles. My dad and mom taught me how to follow Jesus. I learned how to begin my day by waking up every single morning, no matter what time I got up. My mom was up before me in the green chair with her Bible open, staring out the window, and I knew she was in prayer with God. That's how I learned to start my day. I learned how to read the Bible because my dad sat me down at like 7 and said, well, we're going to read through the Bible in a year. And we literally had a rule in our house, like no Bible, no breakfast. I was not allowed to eat until I'd read my Bible. And it wasn't like read a psalm. It was like 2 chapters of the Old Testament, 1 chapter of the New Testament, proverb of the day. Like you have to all year long. I've been reading through the Bible like as long as I can remember, you know. So I was taught and like I grew up and I was parented into Saturday night. We would sit down and my dad would give me our allowance and he would teach me how to tithe off of like 10 cents off of your dollar. And we put it in the little like church envelope. Do they still have those anymore? Like, and you, I don't know if that's still a thing or everything's digital up north, but like with a little envelope and had like the church cheesy 80s logo on it or whatever. And we'd put the 10 cents in and right. I see he gave me this letter the other day. And it was a giving statement from me and it was for like $3.10 or something like that for 1988 or something like that from Santa Cruz Bible Church. And I was like, that's so awesome. There's something powerful about that. My point is, I was parented into these spiritual disciplines. And I was taught Saturday night, here's how you tithe. We don't watch movies on Saturday night. We prepare our hearts for the Lord's Day. And it wasn't called Sabbath. That wasn't our, but there was a value for the Lord's Day. And Sunday was special. It wasn't like sleep in and go to brunch and play video games and listen to the podcast if we're too tired to go to church. It was like, this is the Lord's Day. It starts Saturday night with preparation, with the tithe, with going to bed early, with prayers of family and devotions and getting up the next morning to go to seek God. I was taught all of these things. What I've realized is a couple things happen. As secularism and the post-Christian vision on both the right and the left were coming in and taking over culture through the phone, on the church side, you have the breakdown of the family. So I'm now the first, my generation, millennials, are the first adult generation that's the byproduct of widespread divorce. So 64% of the people in my church come from divorced families. And this is urban core of Portland. You have to make money to live where I live. They're almost entirely educated. And almost most people come from a broken home. Learning about attachment theory through psychology has been fascinating to realize what divorce does to somebody's capacity to attach. And one of the main problems we're dealing with at my church right now is basically attachment disorder and how it's wreaking havoc in communities and how people aren't getting married and people are struggling to like create meaningful connections. Like, it's creating all sorts of problems. Much of it is rooted, obviously, into divorce and what happened in the 80s and 90s with the widespread use of divorce in America. So you have the breakdown of the family. Then you have the death of Sabbath. So you didn't have to teach. So one of my life messages is Sabbath. You didn't have to teach people Sabbath until very recently. Sabbath came to them. So my dad tells stories about growing up in what's now Silicon Valley in the 50s and 60s. So just imagine Silicon Valley, like land of, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Yelp and, you know, all of eBay, Evernote. Everything's right where I grew up. But none of it was there at the time. And he tells stories about growing up. He wasn't even a Christian, but everybody went to church on Sunday. You either went to a mainline church if you weren't a Christian, which is what he went to, I don't know how often, a Catholic church or a Protestant church. And then afterwards, everybody had Sunday dinner. The really liberal people would like go to the park and play baseball, you know, and the Christian people would nap, you know, which we now realize meant mom and dad are having sex, but we didn't know that at the time. I thought it was just napping with the door locked. But now I know what mom and dad were actually doing. Why do they take so many naps? But there was no phone other than like a landline. There's no email. There's no internet. Nothing was open. He still tells about like how 7-Eleven was a game changer. And I looked it up. It was not till 1969 that 7-Eleven opened. And because it was open on Sundays. And it was open late at night. It was like just unheard of, you know? And so you didn't have to teach Sabbath. Like, Sabbath came to you. And so our culture, as it secularized, immediately one of the first things that went was rest and worship. A day for rest and worship. We lost that. I think so much of the sociopolitical pain in our nation right now is rooted in, this is what happens when a generation doesn't have a family, doesn't know how to attach, and doesn't have a day of rest and worship. It's just havoc. And so what I realized was, this is a very long answer to a very short question, I'm sorry, was that I grew up in a model where the family was basically intact, people had basic life skills down. Again, this was my middle class experience. I'm not saying this is all of America. Majority white, all of that. I'm aware of that. Basic life skills, basic family stuff, and the spiritual disciplines were basically taught in the home. Which means you could show up for church. A, people showed up for church every weekend. There was nothing else to do. And they came to church, which now very few people come to church every week anymore. And the pastor could just exegete through Romans. And people already had some basic spiritual disciplines. Most people over 50 in my church, I don't need to teach them the basic spiritual disciplines. They get up in the morning, they read their Bible, they pray, they memorize some scripture, they tithe to the church, they have basic marriage skills, they know that they can't overwork, they need to take some time to rest. Like, I don't need to teach most people over 50 who've been around the church any of that stuff. I can just teach them the more ninja stuff or Bible or theology or cultural engagement, you know. I don't need to teach them, like, this is how you turn off your phone, and this is how you read the Bible, and this is how you pray, and this is how you sit in the quiet. They know that. Everybody under about 50, I literally have to do with them, and I don't mean this in a demeaning way, what I'm currently doing with my three kids who are 9, 10, and 13. Let me teach you, Jude, how to pray. Okay, you're reading your Bible every morning. Great. We're not just here to read our Bible. We're here to seek God. Let me explain. I had a conversation before I left with my son. This is the difference between reading your Bible every morning and seeking the face of God. I teach them how to turn off a device one day a week. I teach them how to not just show up for church, but how to prepare. Like, I'm teaching all of this. Is what just basic parenting. I'm not even a great dad, but this is just basic parenting stuff. And that has not been done for a whole generation. And so what I realized is, oh, wow, I have to go way back to the beginning, not just in worldview. So at a teaching level, I have to go way back in worldview. So we just did all this really in-depth teaching around sexuality and LGBTQ and transgenderism, and Mark Yarhouse was so helpful. We did all this stuff. But first, before we did any teaching on what the Bible says about sex, we had to go way back. I gave a 70-minute message on anthropology, basically. What secularism says, this is who you are. What Jesus and the writers of the Bible say, this is what it means to be human. Because you can't just start talking about what the Bible says is right or wrong. You have to go way back and say, what does it mean to be human? So we have to do that philosophically and theologically. We also have to do it practically, like go way back and be like, this is how you take a day of rest. This is how you read your Bible. This is how you pray. This is what fasting is. This is how you live in community. We're having to teach people. Our home communities are so good, but they're pain points for us because people don't know how to be in long-term interpersonal relationships and deal with conflict. They know how to like make friends on Instagram and meet up for a fun thing, but they don't, some of them, if they're extroverted enough, but they don't actually know, how do you stay in community with somebody once they're annoying? And you know what I mean? Or once your stuff comes out, or once you're in a place of pain and you can't perform and be awesome anymore. So all that to say, that's radically changed how we do church. And it's made me realize I still want to teach the Bible. I still want to do that stuff. But I'm not A.W. Tozer. I don't get the luxury of just like standing up to preach from the Bible every week and just calling religious people to be more passionate. I have to go way back. I have to deal with worldview and practices that make up life. And so much of my work is around those two areas. Not because Bible and theology don't matter, just because I can't do those till I go back and do some of the pre-work.
Yeah. No, thank you. So I'm conscious. I want to give some time for some people to ask some questions of you.
Great.
Because I've asked numerous questions.
I will try to give much shorter answers.
No, but I think what I heard you saying, and this is where I would point people to Mark Sayers and John Mark's podcast, because I think a lot of this cultural milieu that you're describing,
yeah,
you guys get into there. Yeah. And you talk about how isolated our culture is,
yeah,
right, and how we need community. You talk about how image-based and image-conscious our culture is, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think when you talk about this anthropology and going back to the beginning and actually understanding kind of our rhythms of,
yes,
life, it's huge. So thank you for sharing that.
You got it.
Yeah.
It's a joy.
So I'd love to open it up to some questions. I think Bree's got a microphone.
Hi.
Hi.
I've really appreciated so much of what you've said about spiritual formation and especially unintentional formation.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I keep realizing is just how much I've needed to hear that in order to understand it. So I needed to hear it from Jamie Smith in You Are What You Love. I,
yep,
needed to hear John Ortberg preach about it. I needed to hear it from you. And it's just like starting to make a lot of sense. And I'm the college and young adult director here at Trinity. And
amazing.
I'm trying to, you know, communicate a lot of these really important messages about how these students are already being formed. That's the default. And you mentioned the illustration about people growing old and kind of the spiritual polarity of that. But I'm wondering if there's any kind of tangible illustrations that have really landed for you, that you've kind of seen the light bulb turn on for people getting, oh yeah, secularism, the default world is not neutral. Has there been any helpful resources or illustrations that have kind of landed in that way?
In helping people realize that they are being formed.
Right. And in seeing that, you know, the church isn't just offering us this spiritual formation program that's the add-on, you know, it's counterformation. It's something's already forming you.
Yeah.
Because I can talk to them a lot about that, and maybe it'll start to seep in, but it feels like it stays too abstract. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like the elderly person illustration, as long as there aren't elderly people in the room to be offended by it. there are simple ones. Sometimes I use the illustration of coffee. So I'm from Portland. It's like people in our city adore coffee. It's like a religion where I live, and we have some of, if not the best coffee in the world. And it's because the weather is so miserable. We can't go outside, so we just sit inside and drink really good coffee all the time. And it's winter, and you're depressed, and just it helps. So so I talk about how coffee is essentially bad for you, and it's bad for your nervous system. I mean, there are positive health benefits, but the cons so outweigh the pros. And somebody with my personality who is, you know, naturally a little bit more high-strung, prone to anxiety in a busy season of life, if I'm going to pick a vice, it should be marijuana or something, not coffee, you know? Don't worry, I don't imbibe. But I need something to calm me, if anything. The last thing I need to, like, begin my day is, like, here's a jolt of adrenaline running through your system. Like, this is the last thing I need. And, you know, so I know that coffee is bad for me, but I still drink it. When I went through that whole kind of, you know, midlife crisis, and I went off coffee, because it is a drug, like, went off is the right language, for 6 months, and it was amazing. Like, I slept better, I fell asleep faster, I woke up before my alarm, I needed less sleep, I had more mental acuity during the day, I felt closer to God, I had more energy, I got more done. And finally, I just decided it's not worth it. It's too high of a price to pay for a life without coffee. And I went back on, you know, and I was just like, and...
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah,
when everybody leaves, we'll stay in
the
chair.
Don't worry, I still have a therapist. It's a... So people laugh because most of us kind of get that. Like, we probably would be healthier if we didn't have coffee or whatever it is for you, Diet Coke or In-N-Out Burger, whatever your thing is. But we still do it. And it's Jamie K. Smith's whole thing of, you know, why do I drink coffee? It's not because I've made a rational decision in my mind that I will be a better person with coffee. I know that's actually not true in my mind. It's because I love coffee. And his whole thing is you are what you love, and we're more shaped by our desire than we are by our mental framework. And so how did I grow to love coffee? And the answer is through the habit of drinking it daily. I got a job at a coffee shop when I was in high school, and I hated coffee. I thought it was gross. So I would put, like, milk and chocolate and whipped cream in it and, like, drown the flavor of coffee. And this is, like, late 90s. You could have a double mocha with whipped cream or whatever, and you'd make it taste as little coffee as possible. And then eventually that became a mocha with no whipped cream, and then it became a vanilla latte, and then became a latte, and then became a flat white. Then it became, like, now a $9 cup of, like, you know, third wave, single origin, or all the stuff. And now I literally, like, it's like a financial problem in my life is, you know, how do I afford my coffee habit? And my point is just that's through the daily habit of drinking it, I fell in love with it, and it shaped me into the kind of person who loves coffee. So I use that one sometimes just because most people in my city are addicted to coffee, just to be reminded that everything we do does something to us. And it shapes, because what habits do, and there's so much good data and science behind it now, is they... As I understand the neurobiology of it, again, I know just enough to be dangerous, they get in more through your limbic system than through your prefrontal cortex, meaning, in Christian language, they affect your heart more than they do your mind, and it's probably not the best language for it, but they shape what you want and what you love and what you long for. And so watching Netflix is doing something to your heart. Going to the gym is doing something to your love and your longing. Drinking coffee, church, you know, reading the newspaper, anything that you do is doing something to shape your desire. And I think most people, they don't get that intuitively, but the second you start to put language to it, all of a sudden it's like things start to click for them, and they begin to realize, oh, wow, every habit is a spiritual habit, not just the spiritual. The spiritual disciplines are like the Jesus-y counter habits, but everything is a spiritual discipline in the true sense of it's doing something to form your spirit. From watching Netflix at night to eating dinner with your family to going to the gym to reading the New York Times to showing up and doing email to watching cat videos on YouTube. All of this is doing something to you, you know? So I don't know. That's an illustration I use.
What would you say coffee did to your spirit then? If it was, you know, this habit, that
I don't want to answer that question. I want to live in denial of the truth of that question. Is it became Thomas Keating's emotional program for happiness. It did. I don't want to answer that. I decline. I take the Fifth Amendment on that one.
Fair enough.
See, you can always tell when you're getting to the important places when people get defensive. You know that's where Jesus still hasn't gotten to them yet.
Loving this. So thankful. You talk about we need a working theory of change.
Yeah.
You gave us kind of the old theory of theology plus willpower. And then you didn't give us what language are you putting to your church or to yourself in terms of your current working theory? And then how are you guys organizing yourselves at church beyond just, you know, the Sunday context? But how are you actually trying to?
Yeah.
What's the form of the church that for you guys feels like the best way yeah. to get at that?
Oh, gosh, to answer both those questions well would take like a couple hours each, you know. So I'm happy, not to sound weird or self-promoting, but I'm happy to direct you to our podcast. We're 2.5 years into a 4-year-long series. It's not nonstop. We take breaks in called Practicing the Way, and the first 3 months of that are basically, it's 2.5 years old now, so I have updated thoughts, but kind of our working theory of change. So basically, let me give you the very short answer that might not even be helpful. And I have two little slides. Are people on an email chain here? No?
Yeah, we can put them on.
I can give those to you, and you're welcome to send those out. Maybe if I give them to you, you can get them from SIFT if you want a couple diagrams that we've rebuilt our church around. So basically, I wish I had a whiteboard. There's no whiteboard. I don't have a quick answer for this. So basically, I would say we are formed. We have an